Okay, we are up and running. We are recording the review lesson for Sefer Yehoshua. This is the fall semester 2019. I'm not quite sure what happened to the semester. It kind of disappeared really quickly. And today we're going to go through some of the issues. Really, the lesson divides into two parts. We'll do a little bit at the beginning about general questions about the exam, and then hopefully we'll go through some of the items on the review sheet. The whole purpose of this lesson is not to teach you the whole semester in one lesson. That will be very nice, but that is clearly not going to happen today. But what I will try and do is just go over some of the main ideas, main items, etc., that we covered during this semester. But before we get to that, a couple of general comments, and those of you who've done my exams before will know what I'm going to say. The exam itself is a two-hour paper. Obviously, if you have an extra time arrangement, that will be honoured. If it's not happening in this room, wherever the exam will be, then you'll go from the exam room at the end of the time period to the proctoring room, wherever that is. It's usually on the sixth floor, and I will take you there if I'm around. In terms of the exam, it's 5 out of 6 questions. Make it very clear. I do not want heroics. People come along and say, oh, I'll do 6 out of 6 and I'll be a giborah and all the rest of it. There's no Wonder Women. None of that stuff. Okay, without referring to anyone specific. The idea is do 5 out of 6 and, you know, then come sign the paper, give me a nice smile and disappear, because that is the idea of the exam. Please just don't do more than 5 out of 6. I cannot start choosing which one is the better of out of the 6 questions. I'm not going to have time to do that. If you want to do them in any order, you are absolutely encouraged to do so. What I do stress is that every question, I think every question, as far as I can remember, is divided into 2 or 3 parts. So please, please, absolute request to read the exam paper very carefully. Okay, read it once, twice when you start, to make sure that when you answer question 1, and it's 3 parts of the question, if you only answer 2 of those parts, you might have given me the most brilliant answer in the world, but I can only give you 2/3 of the marks, of the points. So, nothing I can do. If you haven't answered part of the question, then you automatically will lose whatever that part is worth. I say this because very often people seem to be in a hurry. Exams always bring out the sense of wanting to get done as soon as possible, which I appreciate. I do understand. I always tell the story, and many of you heard it, of the young lady who decided to do the exam. This was must have been many years ago. It's like 15 years ago. The exam was finishing at 3, and she decided she was flying to Israel from JFK, but she had a flight at 5 o'clock in the evening. So between here and JFK, for some reason, I'm not quite sure what she was thinking, probably wasn't thinking, she thought she could get from Lexington to JFK and check in and be in time for the flight and still finish her exam at 3. Clearly that wasn't happening, and the young lady came in, was very stressed, nothing I could do about it, and instead of taking the normal time, she finished the exam, I don't know, 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and did pass, but certainly did not get the grade that she should have got. So please, please do not make arrangements that put yourselves under pressure. This is true for any exam, but I found that in the past 1 or 2 times this has happened, and I really don't want it to happen to anyone in the room, because it just is not fair to yourself. The exam is 2 hours. Most people finish within, I don't know, an hour, a quarter hour and a half. If you need the whole time, it's fine. Absolutely no problem. And that is, again, you should not put yourself in pressure that, let's say you make an appointment, I don't know, whatever it may be, after the exam is over, just give yourself enough time to finish the exam and to get to your appointment without having to compromise your exam performance. I think this is all obvious, but I always have to say it because inevitably somebody may make that mistake. Even if you're going to a wedding, you know, so you'll turn up a little bit late. If it's in Brooklyn, it won't start on time anyway. Don't worry about it. The issue of writing the exam, many people always ask the same question, what can I use? Okay, so my suggestion always is either black or blue ink. If you are going to write in pencil, and I stress, if you do that, I'm not going to hold it against you in any way, but please make it clear. I once had an exam paper not so long ago written in pencil that was so faint that it was almost impossible to read. So I would ask you, please make sure when you write your exam that you write it clearly. Okay, and ideally you take as much paper as possible. You'll get these delightful little blue books or beige or whatever color they're coming out with this year, I'm not quite sure. And the amount of paper that you need is absolutely limitless. In other words, even if you finish book number one, you have like one more sentence to write, do not write on the covers or on the inside cover, but take book number two, booklet, just put on it book two with your name on the front of the booklet and just finish the one sentence in the new booklet. It's as simple as that. And again, don't be worried about ecology and conserving, saving the world. These booklets, you know, they seem to have a life of their own. They seem to multiply quite happily every time I get exams coming along. I want to just stress again, do not write on the inside covers. I seem to get one exam like that where someone feels they have to write an answer on the back cover. Don't know why. Have no clue what possesses you to do that, but it's something that will not endear you to me. If you finish the exam booklet, the white page, not the blue cover, then for goodness sake, you need another couple of pages to write. Take a new book. Please don't hesitate. I would also say to you, one of the important things about the exam is to have a text with you. Now, what I cannot allow is for you to bring in the Judaica text, okay? But if you want to, for instance, some girls print out a translation, just a Hebrew-English translation from various places, that's usually okay, if it's straightforward translation. If you have a JPS Tanakh, and there are a number of them sort of floating around the building, or if you have even an art scroll, one volume Tanakh, not the one with the commentary, but the one volume which has the whole Tanakh in, it's like a green cover. Anything like that, that will be fine. Because what I'm not here is to test you on your knowledge of Hebrew text. That's not what I'm testing you on. But what I will say is that in any exam answer where you can put in a little bit of text, right, in the original, it will always make me a happy camper. It will always show that, you know, you've got sensitivity to what you learn and you can use it. The obvious example with Yoshua is the phrase Chazak ve'ematz. Okay, don't hesitate if there is any question about Yoshua that you can throw that in and give the whole spiel about all different, we're going to talk about it in our review. Don't hesitate in doing that and ideally write it in the original vernacular in the Hebrew. Let me just see who came in.
Hannah
Gabbard. Okay. Alright. So again, in terms of the books, I can't allow the Judaica Press with the commentary, but I can allow you to bring in a Hebrew-English translation. Again, if you want to make arrangement one between two, and you know you just have it available that you can each use it, that's fine. But again, one has to be very careful with this zero tolerance policy that's going on here, which I don't even want to talk about. It's kind of obvious. Communication during the exam should not take place. So I don't want to get anyone into that situation. But, you know, you make your own arrangement when it comes to text. I just want to stress that. Trying to think what other intros that I need to ask. Yeah, please. Just the straight translation, JPS, Tanakh, Koran, Tanakh, anything like that, but that would be as much as I could allow. If this was a master's, if this was an MA class, then I wouldn't even allow that, right? Because then your knowledge of Hebrew text would be much more being examined. Okay, in terms of, again, the order of the questions I just mentioned, you can do it in any order, I don't really have a problem with that. If you want to answer one question like question one, it has A, B, and C, and you want to do the whole thing in one shot, if it lends itself to that, just be very clear and explain what you're doing. So I know that this answer that you're giving me, the paragraph that you're writing, will be covering the answer to question A, 1A, 1B, and 1C, or maybe 1A and B, or 1B and C. You know, just explain yourselves, whatever you do, if you combine answers to make it absolutely clear what you are doing. Any questions at this point? Anything springs to mind? I think I've covered most of the basic stuff. I'm trying to think what else. Yes, please.
Were there a few questions you gave us?
Yes.
So is that the test?
Well, let me put this, this is not the test, it won't come like this, but you know what I'm saying. The test will be focusing on these topics. So again, 5 out of 6 questions. Each question will have parts to it, so one or two of these might take up, one or two of the review topics might take up one question on the exam. Okay, if you see what I'm saying. It might not be question one is number one, question two, number two. It might be a combination of different things. I try to do the questions in order of the book, and it's usually pretty self-explanatory, you know, what I'm doing in terms of asking the questions. And again, read the paper carefully. 20 points for each question, and the paper's graded out of 100. I do have a time limit, which they give me to get the papers graded, but this is a big group. They usually say 3 days, and I appeal to the good nature of the administration, take maybe a little bit longer, but I try and get it done within a week. So if you're doing the exam, I think December 31st, if I'm not mistaken, that afternoon, then I hopefully will have it graded by the end of the week or by the beginning of the week after. That's my goal. Okay, any other questions of general exam thing? Yes. It could be January 2nd on Thursday, correct. Right? I have a final on the Tuesday, but it may be my Malachim group. I think you're actually right. I don't usually remember these things by heart, as much as I love to, but I really don't. There is an exam that I have to be here on the Friday, but that's a separate issue. But it's not you guys, so you can breathe a sigh of relief, believe me. Okay, now... let's have a look at the review sheet. And again, I've sent these out to you, so I did say, please have them in front of you. Hopefully you've got them on your desktop or whatever. And we'll go through topics one by one, hopefully getting some sort of clearer idea of what we said. The handouts, let me talk about that for a second. They are not to be brought to the exam, but they're certainly a good guide for you to see the sort of ideas and topics that will become focused in the exam. So again, although I have no expectation of you actually going through the handouts, as I said, I'm not here to test your Hebrew language skills, but hopefully on the basis of your notes and what you've written up, exact, you know, sort of stuff that you've covered, the handouts should give you some sort of guide as to, you know, what the issues are. And if you have the handouts organized in a proper way, you'll see that on each one there are notes which I wrote, which will hopefully guide you on what the handout is about. Okay, so again, I think there's enough stuff in your collection. It's usually the handouts run to about 20 handouts, which is quite a lot, but I'm glad that we've got through it. And I'm saying again, please make sure that, you know, you have this sort of general preparation going on. Read the text again from beginning. Make sure you know the basic storyline, because that's always going to be up for questioning, right? You know, even something as basic, what happened to Rachav, something like that. That, you know, just to sort of have in clear in your mind what the basic story is. All right, let's have a look at the review sheet. And we've got here a number of items. Let's do number one. Introduction to the Sefer and the period of entry into Eretz Yisrael. Now, if you look at your notes, at the beginning of the semester, we did talk about the whole question of the purpose of the book of Joshua, right? And what did we say about it? Did we say that it has a special place, or is it just one of the regular books of Tanakh, right? We had something very unique to say about Sefer Yoshua. Anybody? Somebody help me out here, please.
Yeah,
Chesed. That's what I want to hear. The sixth book of the Torah. Because in the end of the day, you think about it, the whole purpose of coming out of Egypt was to get to Eretz Yisrael. And what happens at the end of Sefer Devarim? They're on the edge, they don't go in. Right? They're not in yet. So in order to complete the story the way that we like, with a happy ending, at least we hope it's a happy ending, then coming into Eretz Yisrael is really a completion of the narrative of the Torah. So the sixth book of the Torah essentially is Sefer Yehoshua. Okay? If that's a way to describe it. And of course, what we did say, right, is that according to Chazal, that was really going to be the only book of the Bible that was going to be written because it had to define all the issues of Eretz Yisrael. Who's going to get the territory in the north? Who goes to the south? Who goes to the east? Who goes to the west? All the conquests of Eretz Yisrael, etc. All the other books of the Bible, if you remember, we said they are there because in the course of time, the Jewish people sinned, they did bad stuff, and the Navi, whoever the prophet was at the time, Shmuel or Yirmiyahu, whoever it was, had to come along and write the book of Shoftim. We had to write the book of Shmuel, another prophet finishes off the book of Shmuel. All of that stuff had to be done because the Jews, unfortunately, brought it upon themselves. They needed to be guided. They needed a bit of ethical guidance. And that's the rest of the Tanakh. But the book of Yehoshua is really, really important. It gives us also, we saw the expression in Hebrew, Erekah shel Eretz Yisrael. It establishes once and for all how precious our relationship to Eretz Yisrael really is. And of course, this is something that, as I've tried to do over the course of the semester, to show you that learning the book of Yehoshua is, for everyone who goes into this in a big way, another way of connecting to Israel, which we try to connect to in our lives every single day in the 21st century. We are learning a text, and that text makes our connection just that little bit stronger. When we're facing a propaganda against the Jewish people in the world, which denies our connection to Israel, we hear it all the time, BDS and all the rest of it, then we have to strengthen our keshe. And one of the ways we do it, say the rabbis, is by studying Sefer Yehoshua. So it's a very wonderful book. The time period of Sefer Yehoshua is how many years? From beginning to end? Pretty short. Remember the number, anybody? How many years does it, from start to finish, Sefer Yehoshua? Yeah, 14 was the conquest, 7 years the war, 7 years the conquest, and then another 14 years when all of the land was divided up and the Jews settled in. The whole story, 28 years. Right? That's Sefer Yehoshua. By contrast, just to point out, this book of Shoftim, which is, in fact, shorter than Sefer Yehoshua, right? Not as many chapters. It covers 369 years. So it's a bit of a difference between Sefer Yehoshua and Sefer Shoftim in terms of the dates. Yes, question. Yeah, again, 7 years war when they started, and then 7 years of division of the land, right? That's 14 years. And then the last 14 years was what I call the settling in period. Because they might have been given a portion of land, but they've got to settle in. They've got to start planting and doing all their stuff and building their houses, etc. And that's the other 14 years. And of course, you remember we spoke about Yehoshua delaying the war, for making it last 7 years when it could have been finished much quicker. We'll come to all of that in due course. We did say about Yehoshua a number of very unusual things. What was his background? What tribe did he come from? Where was he born? All right, we did speak about all of that at the beginning. Anybody? Where was he from? Which tribe? The tribe of? Ephraim. Perfect. And where did he come from? What was his background? He had military training. There's a whole question, why was he the one to fight Amalek? Why didn't Moshe choose him? He wasn't yet the close student of Moshe, or he started being that, but why was he the leader of the army at the time? And the answer is because he had that army experience. This is the, to me, a massive chiddush, something really unusual, we learned from somebody called Rav Mali, Elio Mali, which is one of the books we looked at in the course of our study. So he emphasizes Yehoshua's military training in Egypt. There were a number of tribes that were not slaves. That in itself is a revelation. Not everybody was a slave. Yeah.
Do you want us to know like what Rav Mali
I wonder, you don't have to tell me who said anything, but you have to tell me what was said, all right? Because I'm not expecting that to be remembered, because that's not, again, the purpose of the exam. This, the idea of this is to get those ideas and those concepts much more than who said what. And as I said, in a master's degree, that would be completely different. There I would need to know what the Ibn Ezra says as opposed to the Radak, etc., etc. But at this level, absolutely not required. Okay, it takes a bit of pressure off you, but you need to know the concept. Yeah?
There's the question of Pillars and Yeshua, that's the first one.
Not really. Well, it is really the introduction to the Sefer, but it's also comes in right at the end. Right? Because item number 13, if I'm not mistaken, where we came out on two pages, is the whole question, who was Yeshua? Okay, so I talk about it at the beginning, and of course, by the time we finish the Sefer, we'll talk about it again right at the end.
So, like, the question
about that. And that also is really part of the introduction to the Sefer, because that, at the beginning, is the way Yeshua is encouraged, right, to lead. One gets the definite impression, although Yeshua was chosen, there was a certain amount of, let's use the word, I won't use it reluctance, but there was a certain amount of misgiving, you know, who am I to lead? And he wasn't the obvious choice. Nevertheless, but for the purposes of leading the people, he became the obvious choice. And of course, Chazak Ve'ematz, in the beginning, chapter 1 of Sefer Yeshua, is mentioned 4 times. If you remember, we spoke about that. It's to indicate religious leadership, military leadership, all right, general sort of interaction with the people. I've forgotten now. You look at your notes, you'll see all the different variations. And that in itself is really important to understand in terms of Yehoshua's preparedness and his suitability to become the leader of the Jewish people. Okay, so I hope that's clear.
Like,
yeah.
These are going to be broad. Like, the questions are going to be more focused on time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because these are going to be broad topics. So I want to, like, have a guide, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. So the answer is that, although my topic here says introduction to the Sefer, it will be a more specific question.
That goes into 13.
And it sort of links up again, beginning and the end. Because we did a bit about Yeshua at the beginning, and then we do at the end as a kind of afterthought. How do we sum up his leadership from the point of view after he's, you know, passed away or whatever? What we call an obituary. Okay, so we'll come back to Yeshua in that moment. But it's important to understand from the beginning of chapter 1, there is a certain amount of strengthening that goes on. Yeshua initially, Masharet Moshe, this is really important language, he's the servant of Moshe, and then by the time we finish the Sefer, he's Eved Hashem. He's called the servant of God, right? And of course, Eved Hashem is the much more distinguished title because it reflects what Moshe was all about, who was also Eved Hashem. What I didn't put on here, which is very surprising, and I guess maybe it's the introduction to the Sefer, which we did talk about, although it maybe comes out at the end. Yes, we have it really, number 13. I can mention it now. Moshe the sun, Yeshua the moon. The whole question of continuation. Was Yeshua a continuation of Moshe? Or was Yeshua different to Moshe? Alright? And there are elements where he's clearly continuing the tradition, the style of Moshe. And on the other hand, there are situations where he is different. And the story which highlights that to me the most is the story of the one shoe, two shoe, you remember, the end of chapter 5. The end of chapter 5, it talks there about Yeshua being approached by a malach, and the malach says to Yeshua, Yeshua says, who are you? And Yeshua says, and the malach says that I've been sent by God to accompany you, etc. And Moshe was given the same option by God. There's a whole story in Sefer Shemot, and Moshe rejects it, says that we're not going to go down that particular level of being guided by a malach, right? They were in the desert living this elevated existence, and with Yeshua it was very different. And the malach was definitely adopted, but Yeshua's relationship or connection to God was that bit low. When he was told to remove shoes as a sign of being in a holy place, Yeshua took off one shoe, remember, and we said with Moshe it was two shoes when he was at the burning bush. So again, there is this idea, on the one hand, he does continue the legacy, but Yeshua is definitely not the same level of spirituality as Moshe. And I would argue that what we saw by the end of the Sefer is that his interactions with the people were different. Whereas Moshe was people were weeping in the streets when Moshe died, and it says for 30 days the people mourn, and not only that, but all the Torah Baal Peh, so many laws were forgotten. There was a terrible crisis amongst the Jewish people because of the death of Moshe. When it came to the death of Yeshua, remember, that really did not bring out of the people very much reaction. And that becomes a critique, which we'll talk about for those who have signed up to Sefer Shoftim. That's really the discussion beginning of Sefer Shoftim. Alright, any other things that we're going to say about number one? Or I think we're going to move on to number two. Yes, please. The Malach, yeah, we spoke about it at the end of chapter 5. Yeshua took it on, yeah, he saw it as a positive thing. He's definitely a lower level of connection to God than Moshe had. But Moshe was so far out there that, you know, we're not really surprised. Yeshua has this, and this is something that we've had to deal with all the way through. There is this sense that maybe Yeshua, because of his different background, because of his, his whole training, I don't know how to describe it. There's something which did distance him, right? A bit, really, certainly more than distancing Moshe from the people. And that's something which I think became clear as we went along. Okay, to the point where one of the battles, Yeshua turns around and says, I'm not going, the Battle of Ai, right? The first battle, he stays home. And that, again, is very indicative that, you know, he doesn't have that sense of connection, certainly at that point, that he is told about, and we'll see, we'll talk about that in a minute. Number two, let's go to Rachel, one of the real stars of the show. Her life, I'm not going to go through it now, but I would suggest that everybody reads that chapter very carefully. There's two chapters, there's chapter 2 and chapter 6. Chapter 2 is the main story, and chapter 6 is really the follow-up, what happened when Yericho was finally conquered. Her life and lessons for posterity. So obviously what I do talk about, have spoken about, and I'm sure will come up some sort of question about the concept of Rachab being the quintessential Balat Tshuva. Not only is she the quintessential convert to Judaism, but she sets the bar very high. Because her sense of connection to Am Yisrael is really very deep. And it goes into the language. Look at chapter 2. And look for those phrases which are taken from chapter 2, and we have them now in the Aleinu L'Shabeach, the very distinct prayer that we say every day, three times a day. Right? Although traditionally Yeshua wrote it, one gets the distinct impression that it may have originated from Rachav and adopted by Yeshua. Some of that language is already in the language of Rachav, and I think that's really something unique. In terms of what she was, Rachava Zonah, never really forgotten the title. And remember we said there were two options. Really, I think they're both the same. One says that she was some sort of Balat Mazon. She used to supply food. She had some sort of place like a B&B. But also Zonah in the literal sense that she was a lady of prostitution. In which case, that makes the spies going to her particular house much more logical, because so many men were coming in and out, who would notice two more, right? The problem was that they, Yericho seems to have been on the lookout, right? I was thinking about it, how did Yericho know so quickly, people of Jericho, that these two were not regular clients of Rachab? And one has to understand that, you know, it's a small place, they would recognize who was going in, who was going out, and these two men were clearly different. Maybe they looked different, they dressed different, who knows? Right, we're not really sure. Yeah.
Just a question on Rahab.
Yeah.
So the commentary say that her place, her home, whatever, was at the edge of the city.
Yes.
And in terms of practicality, do you think that the spies went to her house first? It was right there.
It was right there. They didn't have to go through
they
the city.
Yeah.
They weren't going to do a reconnaissance, to look at the city, go to every corner of the city to check it out. Once you speak to Rachab, and she knows everybody, She's connected to every man, every minister, every who knows what she's connected to in Yericho. She will tell you where all the pitfalls are. She gave them all the information.
But they didn't right? know beforehand.
Sorry?
They didn't know beforehand.
No, they didn't know. They
let you know.
Yeah, even so, the whole idea here was that every conquest was going to be b'derech hateva, right? One of the big things that happens when they go into Eretz Yisrael is everything becomes on a natural level. And although supernatural events take place, the walls come down, but the preparation and everything about it is much more of a natural order. And that's the way they had to live in Eretz Yisrael. They started living and just snapping their fingers and not having to work, and everything was done by miracle, then that would not necessarily be a good situation. You know, people will become very indifferent, and in the end, who knows what would have happened. It didn't go well anyway, but that would have been even worse. All right, so that's the whole story with the people going to Rachav. Her house was in the wall. Remember, when the wall came down in chapter 6, her house was not the wall facing as you come into Jericho. Seems to have been on one of the side walls. Her house was built in the wall. So you can imagine how thick the wall was, right? May not have been a big house, but whatever, a couple of rooms. But the reality was, this is a very, very thick wall. But when they walked into Yericho, remember we explained that they only walked in direct. They did the walls on the side, according to the way it was explained, did not fall down. It was only the facing wall, the wall facing them. That collapsed, all the rubble went into the ground. Like an earthquake, it disappeared. And the ground was flat, and then the Jewish army could just go in, and the war was basically won at that point. The enemy just gave up, and they didn't fight. Well, if they did, it really we're not told about it. But the king was captured, and the king was killed. Okay, so again, when it comes to Rachav, so much to say. Obviously, talk a little bit about what happened to her. She made that commitment to Am Yisrael, and who did she marry? Right, everybody knows. In the end, Yehoshua. She married Yehoshua. Married the boss. Okay. Not a bad idea. And in her case, it was an amazing idea. And again, the continuation of Moshe with Yehoshua, one of the things that we did mention, and if I didn't, I should have done, is that Moshe marries a Gioret. He marries a woman who converts to become Jewish, Tzipora, and Yehoshua also marries a Gioret. Right? Not by chance. Moshe and Yehoshua Yehoshua in this case is copying his Rebbe. And it makes sense. Because if you're the leader at that level, to already be bound to marry someone who is connected in the people, you'll always be open to claims of what they call nepotism, protection, whatever word you want to use. It was not a good thing, right? So you marry a woman who comes completely from a different place, from a different world, and your reputation is solid. You don't have to worry about people complaining whether you're biased or otherwise. So it makes sense that Yehoshua marries Rachav, Rachav marries Yehoshua, and they do not have any sons, but they have daughters. And eventually, Nevi'im, prophets descend, her descendants become Nevi'im. The Gemara talks about that. So again, lessons of Rachav, particularly about her commitment, her tshuva, and the Chut HaShani, right? Remember that string, which, although signifies the rope to climb out of the window, it also has the extra significance of tshuva, because it's the same color that the Torah describes for the string that was used on Yom Kippur. Okay, so therefore, when they make a siman that she puts this string in the window, when they come and attack the city, that they won't attack her house if they see the string, not just by chance that they choose that color signifies again her connection, her act of tshuva, her repentance and commitment to the Jewish people. So again, all of these themes are very beautiful things, and Rachav is clearly someone to think about and to prepare. Any questions about Rachav? I think we're going to move on. Definitely one of my favorites. Number 3, the spies, comparison to the sending by Moshe. We did talk about that. We said that in the end of the day, isn't it surprising that in chapter 2, Yehoshua sent spies? He was one of the spies that surely should know from the story with Moshe how bad it was to send spies. And the answer was that there's a big difference. The spies of Moshe were called tayarim, latur et haaretz. Tayar in modern Hebrew means a tourist. They went to check out the land. not as a military operation, just to go and see it, right? Moshe was very concerned, the people were concerned, they didn't know what they were going to, so he said, go and check it out, the Tayer et Haaretz. What happened was, however, Vayiraglu, Vayiraglu regel is the idea of spying with your feet, meaning checking all the military positions. So what happened was, the problem with Moshe's spying mission, this is the Malbim's explanation, he says it turned from being a pilot trip, it turned into a military spying thing. And that of course was a problem because it showed they had doubts in their faith of the promise from Hashem. Hashem said, you're going to go into this place, you're going to win, you're going to be there, you're going to be strong, and they're going in, sending spies, wondering if they've got enough strength to be able to conquer. And the spies came back and created a whole problem, a massive problem. So that whole story of Moshe was different to Yoshua because that was a mission gone wrong. However, with Yoshua, it was purely spying, was purely military, and would have made perfect sense because they needed to know the lay of the land in order to conquer Jericho. Right? They need to know where to go, how big the city was, etc. All the information that Rachav could give them, that was precious information. The background, we did speak about that Yoshua had sent letters to all the leaders of the tribes living in Eretz Israel, and he sent three different letters saying to them three options. Either you give in and we will adopt you, we will make sure that you're protected, right, and you will work for us, or you give them the option to run away, which one of the groups did. The Girgashi ran to Africa, according to tradition. And the third option is that we're going to make war. And clearly, by not returning the invitation of Yeshua in those three approaches, those three letters, the announcement was being made loud and clear that the people in Eretz Israel were going to fight. It turns out that Rachel was one of the few people that had made peace, had already... Now, there's a question whether she'd made any connections before the Jews came in, right? I'm not sure whether we spoke about that. Again, not going to come up in the exam, but it is intriguing. Maybe she already had some sort of kesher with the Jewish people before they even came into Eretz Israel. It's not clear to me that she did, but, you know, we can speculate about that. But certainly she was one of the few that accepted the peace offering. She really did. And the other one, the Givonim, we're going to talk about in a minute. Yes, Kira. That again is all the spies, etc. In the beginning of chapter 2. It's all Perek Bet. Okay. We'll move on. Number 4, the events of the 10th of Nisan. Yardane and the stones. Okay. Yardane and the stones. So the 10th of Nisan is an amazing day. We spoke about it because they had to prepare. It's very similar to the preparation, three-day preparation, which is reminiscent of the preparation for receiving of the Torah. So what we did say is that a lot of the events coming into Eretz Israel are parallels in a way to the events of receiving the Torah, and one of the biggest things when they crossed over the Jordan was the fact that there, at that moment, Yeshua made a covenant. A covenant with the Jewish people as they're crossing over, that they made a commitment to each other. We spoke about it. Kol Yisrael. Here's a phrase that you can certainly remember to put into your test. Kol Yisrael arevim zeh bezeh. Alright? One of those phrases that you should know by heart. Every Jew becomes responsible for every other Jew. And this is a very unique commitment that people made. And Yeshua insisted. Yeshua said, we're coming into Eretz Israel, we are not going to disappear into our corners and not worry about each other. We have to make the commitment at that moment of the miracle of crossing the Jordan, we are making the commitment to God and to each other. Okay? And that, I think, is really significant. That's the 10th of Nisan, and that's what was going on. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, Kol Yisrael Arivim. And Arivim is with an Ayin. Ayin Resh Bet Yud Mem Arivim Zebazet. Right? Are responsible for each other, are connected to each other. And it's one of those phrases, even if you write it in English, it will be fine, just to explain that this is one of the requirements of coming into Eretz Israel. And it always has been. And one of the great things that we live in the 21st century is the knowledge that with unity, right, achdut, caring for each other, connecting to each other, that's what makes Eretz Yisrael very strong. There are so many examples in modern history, particularly during the war period, Six-Day War, where not only were the Jews in Israel connected so deeply with each other, with the fate, the common fate that was literally either do or die, it really was at that point, but the whole Jewish world was also connected at that time. It has happened since then on a number of occasions, and it's one of those things that we look forward to again, hopefully without having to have a war to bring everybody to connect with Israel. It's really, hopefully can be done without wars. Yes?
So in regards to this stone, and like we said, there are two sets of stone, the one with the water and the one with the
stone. Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, each one had 12 stones. Yeah, we're just going to talk about that. The question of the Yarden and the stones, that Yeshua decides going to make some sort of memorial, right? If we did have this incredible nace, well, let's memorialize it. So he did two things. He took stones which were placed in the River Jordan to mark the crossing point. And in fact, if you look at the notes, you'll see, I think we mentioned one, there's a statement of one of the rabbis in the Talmud that he went to that spot and he found the remnants of these stones. That's already 1,000 years after it happened. Today we don't have the remnants, but I wonder if anyone's really looked for them in the 21st century. We'll have to wait and see. They may turn up one day. The second bunch of stones that he took out of the Jordan, he took to a place called Gilgal. And in Gilgal he made a mizbeach, he made a special altar to give thanks to Hashem, and they wrote a part of the Torah, some say the whole Torah, but that would have to definitely require a miracle of some sort. So it could have been the Aseret HaDibrot, as I mentioned, maybe the Ten Commandments, something which was significant on the side of the Mizbeah. They made their sacrifices, then they took the thing down, took it back to where they were lodging at the beginning, and we'll see later on, in fact, that the altar was again, I think it was used later if we actually mention it. But the basic thing was that there were two sets of commemorative stones. One marking where they crossed, and the other one was taken in order to build an altar, a mizbeah. Okay? And there was a third set of stones, just to make life complicated, but that wasn't the stones that came into Israel. That was done when Moshe was still alive. A third monument of some sort, difficult to describe what it was, but it was some sort of, again, may have been a mizbeah, some sort of item on the other side of the Jordan, which, as I mentioned, became like the mezuzah to Eretz Israel. Coming into Eretz Israel, they would set up some sort of memorial with stones, and on that also they wrote the words of Torah, or some say Mishnah Torah, the book of Devarim, and on that would be the instruction, the guidebook, the constitution for the Jews in Eretz Israel. And therefore that in itself is so significant, is so beautiful, such a beautiful idea, like we have a mezuzah on our doors, hopefully to protect our homes. They understood that with the Torah at the entrance of Eretz Israel, that hopefully will protect the Jews in Eretz Israel. And it's true to say, with hindsight, looking at Tanakh, that when the generations were connected to Torah, they were pretty much under the protection of God. It's when they started moving away is when the trouble began. So that's basically the 10th of Nisan, the Yarden, etc. All of this stuff, pretty amazing. One of the events which is particularly significant is what happened after the 10th of Nisan, the Korban Pesach. Right? That is, I think, chapter, if I'm not mistaken, chapter 5. I think it was Perek Hay. Or Perek Dalet and Perek Hay, right? Those two Perakim, the Brit Milah. I want to mention very significantly about the link to Eretz Israel of Brit Milah, and it's really important because we say it in the benching every single day. If we eat bread, we have Birkat HaMazon, and in the Birkat HaMazon, we talk about Nodeh Lecha, we give thanks to Hashem for Eretz Chemda Tova Rechava, for giving us the land of Israel. And in the middle of that, we say, Ve'al Britcha Shechatamta Bivsarinu. We say, we recognize the covenant that God has made, the Brit Milah. So everybody asks, what's that got to do with the whole theme of the paragraph of Eretz Israel? And the answer is, and again, this comes back to the whole story of Yeshua, that one of the first mitzvot that they did in Eretz Yisrael was to have the Brit Milah of all the thousands of people that had not had Brit Milah in the desert. Remember, we said the desert was not conducive. The winds were damaging, or if you look at your notes, I think we spoke a number of reasons why. And for those 38, 39 years they were in the desert, they didn't do Brit Milah. They came into Eretz Yisrael, and here's the crazy part of the story. They literally, every male was for 3 days hospitalized, or the equivalent, by having Brit Milah. They couldn't move for 3 days. And it was a statement of Emunah. We did speak about it. To do Brit Milah, they had to do it to do the Korban Pesach. You can't bring the sacrifice if you're not if you don't have a Brit Milah. So that was requirement to do the Korban Pesach. But more than that, it was a statement of faith that they were in a position where they were in Eretz Israel and possibly could be attacked by the enemy. And they nevertheless went ahead and did Brit Milah, and everything turned out fine. Okay, so again, it's one of those things to remember. Al Britcha Shechatamta Bivsarenu. That gives us the connection to Eretz Israel. And I think I might have mentioned when I spoke about this, a talk I once heard from Rabbi Frand in Baltimore, where he talks about the fact that many people are wondering what is the connection of the Arab community. Why is it that they can hold on so strongly to Eretz Israel, you know, in their world, as well as we do in our world? And one of the answers given from our perspective is that they also do Brit Milah, right? They adopted the mitzvah as they had from their tradition, from Abraham through Ishmael. And the reality is that this mitzvah, for reasons I can't explain, because that seems to be a bit more Kabbalistic or whatever, the connection to the land through Brit Milah is very, very strong. And that's something which we do mention, and particularly in Eretz Yisrael, if you ever attend a Brit Milah in Eretz Yisrael, they even, I think, even the Bracha of Shechianu is recited, which is not recited outside Eretz Yisrael. It's given a very special significance in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so again, I think that's just important to remember and something to bear in mind. Any questions? Any comments? We're going to move on. We're going to run out of time. Number six, the battles of Jericho and Ai. Pretty straightforward, right? Joshua fought the battle of Jericho and the walls came tumbling down. Ai is much more sensitive, although Jericho, you can certainly talk about the way that it was so much more spiritual. We commemorate the battle of Jericho with our Sukkot celebration. Holding lulav is like holding a spear, and we go around the shul to remind ourselves that in the end of the day, it wasn't an earthquake that some people claim it was when they made the big noise on the seventh day, but it was in fact a tremendous miracle. The problem was Yoshua's cherem. What did Yoshua say about the property in Jericho? Anybody?
Not to take the spoils.
He absolutely made it forbidden. And he did it of his own accord. And we spoke of the reasons why. And if you look at your notes, you'll see. It was on Shabbos, the whole thing. He didn't want people to benefit from things that were done on Shabbos. It's a whole bunch of different reasons why he made the cherem. And that created a problem. And the problem was that there was one person, right? Achan, Ayin Chaf Nun, Achan. And he comes along and says, they won't miss this. Little bit of this, little bit of that. Takes like a sweater, and he takes a bit of money or whatever it was, and he took it for his own personal benefit. The next thing that happens, they go to the Battle of Ai, number one, and they lose, and 36 men are killed, or some say it was Yair, the head of the Sanhedrin, was the equivalent of 36 people, because in the Sanhedrin, 36 majority of 36 outweighs the 35, and he would have always been the casting vote. I think he was the head of the Sanhedrin. So, whatever you say, whether it was one person who died or 36 people who died, but it was a shock. It was a battle. The Battle of Ai, number one, was a real shock. Yoshua became overconfident. He sort of sat back. He didn't go. He sent 2,000 soldiers, I think is the number. It clearly was not enough. And as a consequence, they got a real wake-up call. Right? And again, sometimes, as I mentioned, there are certainly modern equivalents to think about in terms of these situations, the Yom Kippur War as opposed to the Six-Day War. No question that was a very different situation with a certain amount of, let's say the word, they took their eye off the ball. They really did not watch on Yom Kippur 1973 the sort of build-up that was happening in the way that they did in 1967. And that's been recognized, and it created a tremendous after effect in Israel. The Yom Kippur War was very, very traumatic. Yes? Sorry, again? Battle of Jericho. And the problem was, Yeshua made that as an extra precaution. It's not forbidden by the Torah, but it's forbidden by Yeshua. So there's a whole question, once one person takes the spoil, what happens next? And we know that this created a problem, and therefore Yeshua had to find out who it was, and that's the whole story. You'll read again in chapter 8, when they analyze what happened, and again, the messages are very, very strong. Similarities between Jericho and Ai are, in the end, that both of them, the kings were killed, both of them, the battles, had elements of miracle to them, but in the main, they were both conducted in a physical, material presence that had to take place. The Battle of Ai was particularly interesting because of the tactic, having, bless you, the tactic of the two groups behind the city. One group was hiding to come into the city to take it over when the soldiers leave Ai. The Jewish soldiers came in from the other side of the city, but there was another group further away which were there to cut off any reinforcements. Remember, there was a third group. There was one group at the front of the city who tempted the soldiers to come out. There was another group at the back of the city who were definitely hiding, did not want to be seen. But there was a third group further away, and that also gave the people of Ai some sort of sense that, look, the Jews, they're not even coming close. They're staying away from our city, and they became overconfident. And, of course, the next thing you know, the whole city is destroyed. Sorry, this was the second battle, yeah. The first battle was really a very big problem. It wasn't approaching the right attitude. There's a lot of stuff that was learned from the first one and was applied in the second one. One of the great things about the book of Yeshua is that they do try to learn from their mistakes, right? As opposed to many of the other books of Tanakh, where there is this constant error going on of idolatry, whatever it is, and you don't see people learning from the mistake. You see people responding to the trouble, reacting to what's going on, but they don't seem to learn. They don't seem to take it on board. They don't seem to change their ways. And with the book of Yeshua, every step of the way, there is a message, there is a limud, a lesson, and they do learn from it. And that's very exciting. That's something which, again, you know, that's, as they say, a credit to Yeshua and to his leadership. All right, so that's number 6. I hope that's clear. Any questions, or otherwise I'm moving on. Yes, 1 and 2, please.
Okay. You said that the Battle of Ai was like a wake-up call for them. Do you mean in terms of like them not relying too much on miracles, or like wake-up call that like everything that they do is like affecting what happens to them, like us taking
this? Correct. The big wake-up of a bit of communal responsibility, okay. Right? And that is something which they needed reminding. They made the covenant, for goodness sake, they'd actually promised it, but they didn't keep it. So along comes the Battle of Ai, and that really, you know, becomes the moment when it's clear that there is a problem. And as a consequence, they learn the lesson, and the second Battle of Ai is amazing. Absolutely amazing. So it's a very different reaction. So that's a good question. There's another question over here. Yes?
I'm a little confused. There were two battles? Of
Ai, yes, absolutely.
Okay, so then...
The what?
Remember I said there's three groups of people, like their tactic of like one was worried.
Ah, that's the second battle. I even gave you a handout with a picture, an aerial photo, right? Look at your handouts because it's there. It's an aerial picture of the tactic, right? There was the Jewish army was divided into three parts. Part number one was facing the city, waving at the people of Ai and saying, "Here we are, come and get us." So the people of Ai said, "Yeah, we're gonna come and get you." And all the soldiers started running out of Ai, okay, and they started going towards the Jewish soldiers who looked as if they were running away. But of course, what they did was, in the meantime, the group which was behind the city, 30,000 I think it was people, pushed into the city, right? They pushed into the city from the back, started because only women and children were left in the city. They overtook it very quickly. They set fire to the city. And then the soldiers from Ai look back and they see the whole city is up in flames. And of course, at that point, the Jewish army had won. The third group was further away between Ai and Beit El, right on the road, and they were there to block any reinforcements that would have come from another place. Right, it says 5,000 of them waited on the road. They also gave the impression that they were hanging back from the city. So the people in Ai would see the 5,000 waiting in like a mile away, and they would get the impression, ah, they're scared, they're not coming close. But of course, not realizing that that 5,000 was a small group, and the 30,000 that were waiting to come into the city, they were hiding, camouflage, and they weren't seen. So you see what's going on here. There's literally three groups of the army. It's very, very clever. And as I mentioned, a number of times, some of these battles were replicated in the wars which Israel has had with the Arab world, because they, very often, the leaders of the Israeli army through the last 70 years have been scholars of the Bible. Not necessarily religious, but certainly knowledgeable of Tanakh. So it's quite amazing how they saw this as a guideline, how to conduct certain battles even in the 20th century. It's really something. Number seven, the Givonim. Givonim were this very crafty, scheming bunch of people. They said, look, we're really in trouble. We saw that Jericho fell and Ai has fallen. And you know what's going to happen? You know, everything else is going to be destroyed. We have to try and save our skins. So what did they do? They made out as if they were a group coming to pay homage to the Jewish people from far, far away. They changed their clothes, they made that as if they traveled a long distance, and they came into the Jewish camp, and they made up a whole story of a Sipuri Savta, as it's called in Hebrew. Nobody could really fool them on it, because they sounded so convincing, and Yeshua makes a promise. Yeshua promises that they could be incorporated, they would become what we call Ger Toshav, people who are Gerim, not in the full sense of converts, but they certainly are people who become monotheists. They believe in one God. They keep the seven laws of Noah. And that was fine until they found out who they really were. And once they found out who they really were, the people were angry. And the people said, they tricked us. Yeshua, what should we do? And Yeshua says, we can do nothing. Right? We have made a promise. And we can now not break the promise. And the bottom line, says the Gemara, because if they broke their promise, it would create, what's the expression? Very important expression. It would create a Chilul Hashem. Very, very good. Remember that. Chilul Hashem. It would really desecrate the name of God. People would say the Jews are making promises and they don't keep them, etc., etc. And that would be a bad thing. So the reality of the Givonim is, again, a mixed blessing. On the one hand, they certainly got away with what they did, and they should never have got away with it, but they did. But more to the point, it shows the responsibility of Yeshua. And I've got an impression part of his popularity must have dropped at that point. Because people were so incensed how the Givonim had got away with it, that it seems to me that Yeshua, at that point, maybe by staying with his story and not giving in, might have lost popularity. I don't know. You can look at the story and make up your own mind. Number eight, the miracle of Givon and Ayalon. The song and the prayer of Yeshua, that's the famous story of the sun standing still, and all of the descriptions, obviously, you know, worth going over your notes to remember how many opinions there are that the day was elongated, and how Rabbi Levi explained that the sun stopped in the middle of the sky for a very short period of time, and then it started going down through the afternoon. But it gave enough time, 7 or 8 hours, between the moment that the sun came down to where it stopped before the moon came up, right? And that's the distance that it would take from going from one place to the other, from Givon, down to Emek Ayalon, which is where the enemy was running away. And of course, at that point, the miracle happened and the sun did not set, either for 24 hours, 48 hours, or I think, according to one opinion, even for 72 hours. And of course, at that point, Yeshua makes this fantastic prayer, or some say a shira, where he talks about Shemesh B'Givon Dom, and one of the few examples, rabbis say one of the only examples, where it says that man decreed and God fulfilled. Right? Tzadik gozev Hashem mekayem. The tzadik announced what was going to be, and God fulfilled the word of the tzadik. And again, look at your notes on that. It is certainly worthy of attention. Number nine, I'm just rushing because we're getting to the end of the session. The delay, the end of the war. Again, we spoke about that, what Yeshua did, and is he to be criticized for it? Some do, some don't. Rashi is clearly critical, right? Rashi brings the sources which criticize Yeshua. Could have finished the war in 3 months, and he ended up taking 7 years. And Reb Levi explains that other commentaries saw it as Yeshua's concern. His concern for the future. It ties in what we said about the two speeches at the end. Yeshua was worried that the future of Am Yisrael, when he's not around, they would get embroiled in idolatry and other bad things. So to avoid that, he wanted to stay around as long as possible. Not for his own benefit necessarily, but for the benefit of Am Yisrael. But however, on the surface it looked bad, and he actually died 10 years prior to the time that his Rebbe died. Moshe was 120, Yeshua was 110. Seems to have been punished for that particular strategy. Lessons from Achsa, daughter of Kaleb. That's just one item which we did speak about, right? The whole that's in chapter 15, which we spoke about. Just the whole story there of Kalev and Otniel. The whole story there. Again, I would say to you, don't drive yourself crazy on that particular subject. But it was one of those things that we did mention. I just put it on the review sheet because, again, worth looking at what we said. The whole connection with Kalev and the two half brothers, Kalev and Otniel, and the message from the story of Achsa, etc. Have a look at your notes if you were here. If you weren't here, I would not worry too much about that. The number 11 is important, which is the relationship with the two and a half tribes. Before Yeshua takes his farewell, they leave their own mark on the Eretz Israel. They leave a Mizbeach on the edge of the River Jordan, and the people go nuts. The people go crazy. They start thinking, the rest of the tribe, they start thinking that this two and a half tribes going out of Israel to the other side of the Jordan are telling us they're going to become Ovdei Avodah Zarah, they're going to worship idols. They left the Mizbeach. What is the altar going to be symbolic of? It's going to be symbolic of sacrifices, maybe even human, who knows? God forbid. And the people started going crazy. They made a whole delegation. They took Pinchas and they go and talk to the two and a half tribe. And of course, the commitment of the two and a half tribes was very sincere. And quite the contrary, they on the opposite side of the whole discussion, they come out with this commitment of committing themselves to observance of Torah in their new home, which will be on the other side of the Jordan. The final speech, please look at what we said, because that is really important. The two speeches. Speech number one, Yeshua gave to the people, the leaders. And the reaction of the leaders was? Zero. Right? No reaction. So Yeshua says, wait a minute, this is not good enough. I gave a whole pep rally here for the leadership, that they can go and inspire the people, but they didn't react. They didn't say anything. And I warned them that if they go and without me, they continue the dangers of idolatry and intermarriage, etc., etc. And Yeshua says, I've got to call everybody to Shechem. He calls everybody to Shechem, and a second meeting, a second speech is given, which is to the whole nation. And that becomes much more significant, because the people say the equivalent of, what's that famous phrase? They said at Mount Sinai, Naaseh Nishma. They said equivalent of Naaseh V'Nishma, and that is for Yeshua the ultimate commitment that he wants to see from Am Yisrael before he dies. The final comment, number 13, which is Moshe is the sun, Yeshua is the moon. That clearly suggests that Moshe was the energy, the source of the energy, the holiness. Yeshua is the reflection of it, the continuation and change we spoke about. And again, who was Yeshua to sum up his life, looking at it from the end? The successes and the challenges. The chazak ve'emat. He obviously needed to be told chazak ve'emat. That suggests that without it, there was a certain lacking of chazak, strength, emat, and courage. Right? That therefore Yeshua is not the quintessential leader of, like Moshe. There is a certain amount of support that he requires. But by the time you get to the end of Sefer Yeshua, Eved Hashem, and that's a beautiful thing. He gets this title at the end, the servant of God. We spoke last time about who wrote the last few psukim, and remember, I wanted to make that point that the end of the book teaches us that even if he didn't write it, it's as if he wrote it, because it's not about the person writing the sentence like Moshe, but it's about the influence that they had and what they left behind. Moshe, the presence of Moshe, even in the last 8 psukim of the Torah, is without question. It's there. Even if he's not writing it, he's talking about his death. But Yeshua has the same effect. At the moment he dies, he's not there at the end of the book. But clearly it's the same message. That message of the presence, the Kedusha of these people, same with Shmuel HaNavi. And I think that again is a very beautiful, in a way, a very beautiful end to our study of Sefer Yeshua. Let me say 2 things. Number one, that as always, it's a big group, and not always can I see even people sort of right at the corner there. Hila, I know Hila's sitting there, but I've got to wave to make sure you can see me. But saying that, it's always been my joy, really. Number one, I learned so much. Particularly, I have to say that the essays that you produced were really outstanding. I found a lot of good stuff, a lot of interesting stuff, which, although I've taught this course a number of times, every time I teach it, I get so much from you guys, particularly in writing this time, and I'm very grateful for that. I also want to say to you that any questions, anything that comes up in your review, don't forget the email address, you should know it by heart, okay, ribshaf@aol.com, don't hesitate, and again, just do your, as they say, due diligence, look at what you have to look at. Questions that you may have, I'll try and answer as best I can. And I hope that the exam will be a learning experience. We've got to do it, one of those realities, but I hope even there you'll come out with something a bit more than the usual, and you'll all do well. I look forward, I know my classes, I think Shoftim is already oversubscribed, so I hope to see some of you next semester. And, in the meantime, really hope everybody does well in their finals. Good luck, everybody. Thank you for listening. Have a good Shabbos, everyone. That's the most important thing.
Thank you.
Thank you.